and welcome to Time Magazine. I'm Randall Rickman for North Carolina Reading Service, and for this next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and welcome to our magazine. The issue we're reading today is dated February 3rd, 2020. Make sure that we fit in the interview feature for this edition. We go right to the back of the magazine. This week, the interview feature is entitled Seven Questions. The interviewer for Time is Jeffrey Kluger. The interviewee is William Gibson. Time says, the sci-fi novelist on inventing the term cyberspace, the surprising way AI could be truly intelligent, and the ending he regrets. First question. In the same way Hunter S. Thompson and Pablo Picasso gave us gonzo journalism and cubism, you've been credited with creating cyberpunk and inventing the term cyberspace. How do you plead? Answer. I remember early in my career looking at a yellow legal pad and on which I had written down infospace and dataspace, and they just looked woefully unsexy. Then I wrote cyberspace, and it just rolled off the tongue. Since then, I've discovered that a Scandinavian artist previously used it in an abstract painting. Cyberpunk is not my coinage. I was with a group of sci-fi writers, and someone called us that, and I said, don't buy this. We were already marginalized as sci-fi writers. Cyberpunk would marginalize us further. Question. Much of your work takes place in the near future, though in your new book, Agency, you look a full century ahead. Is there a certain plausibility and accountability in not moving too far ahead in time? Answer. If one wants to escape the present, one goes for the Galactic Empire 600 years from now. But I'm not interested in that. And even if one writes about 600 years from now, in 100 years, people will still see it as something written in 2020, because it will bear all those attitudes. Question. 9 of your books are trilogies. Have you gone into them with that in mind, or did you begin the first of each as a standalone book? Answer. I absolutely intended the first ones to be standalone. And I have never been able to stick to that. Agency is more conventionally a sequel, parenthetically, to 2014's The Peripheral, because I've gone back to the same characters. In past sequels, I've dealt with other characters having different experiences in the same world. Question. You credited with a sort of clairvoyance for foreseeing the internet and VR. Is there anything you've gotten wrong? Answer. I can imagine a bright 12-year-old picking up 1984's Neuromancer and think it's a book about something happening to all the cell phones because I didn't predict them. Sometimes I've been right and wrong at the same time. I could not imagine the complete collapse of the Soviet Union. So I wrote it as sort of a non-fully capitalist economic backwater. If I had simply called it Russia, I'd have been right on the dot. Question. If you had to leave science fiction and try another genre entirely, what would it be? Answer. I would try something that isn't identifiable as genre fiction, but you get into practical considerations like packaging. I get a guilty feeling because I think if I were someone running into an airport bookstore and buying 2010's Zero History, thinking it's going to be a thriller, then suddenly I'm reading this extended meditation on the influence of military garment design on streetwear, I'd be pretty disappointed. Question. Is there a book of yours you would rewrite? Answer. When I was finishing 1999's All Tomorrow's Parties, I had a lot going on in my life, and I could have done more with the final moment and the emergence of the singularity. In effect, I said, and it happens. I would have taken a 2-month break and done a final pass on the last 30 pages. Final question. Agency includes an intelligent digital assistant named Eunice. Do you envision a world partly populated by Eunices? Last answer. I'm not positive. Even people who know a lot about AI are divided. It's been posited that what we think of as sentient AI is more likely to be a heavily modified human consciousness in a living human body who has all of the capacities of the system and is no longer human. All of my Eunice-like characters are really a longing for a better Siri or Alexa. Entire interview conducted for Time by Jeffrey Kluger with William Gibson, sci-fi novelist. The books mentioned by William Gibson are Agency, also The Peripheral, Neuromancer, that is spelled Neuromancer, and also All Tomorrow's Parties, William Gibson. We go now to the beginning of the book, and before we get to the brief, which opens the major sections in the magazine, we have For the Record, the one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing, a headline or caption in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from, Time says, a National Archives spokesperson on January 19th on the decision to blur some signs in a photo from the 2017 Women's March that appears in an exhibit marking the centennial of women's suffrage. And the quotation from a National Archives spokesperson, quote, we made a mistake, unquote. In the middle right margin of the page is the feature within a feature, bad week, good week. At bad week, sweethearts. The Valentine's Candies producer predicts possible shortages this year. Under good week, Snickers. In Texas, Mars Rickley shows off a 12-foot-long Snickers bar, the largest ever. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in red from Yeo B. Yin, Malaysia's environment minister, announcing the country was sending more than 4,000 tons of plastic waste back to the countries it came from. And the quotation from Yeo B. Yin, quote, if people want to see us as the rubbish dump of the world, you dream on, unquote. The lower center of the page on the bottom, a story illustrated by the statistic in bold black, 14.65 million. Caption explains, the number of babies born in China last year, as the country's birth rate dropped to 10.48 per 1,000 people. And again, the number of babies born in China last year, 14.65 million. Caption goes on to say, its lowest point since at least 1949. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Gary Cohn. That's spelled C-O-H-N. Gary Cohn, former White House chief economic advisor, on CBS's Face the Nation on January 19th, days after the Trump administration signed a trade deal with China. And the quotation in gray from Gary Cohn, quote, "I don't think the tariffs helped," unquote. In the middle left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Simone Biles, Olympic gymnast, on January 20th, at a new training center for USA Gymnastics, after the organization severed ties with a facility where disgraced Dr. Larry Nassar abused victims. And the quotation in red from gymnast Simone Biles, quote, "Change is hard, especially in gymnastics," unquote. In the upper left corner and margin of the page is a quotation from, is illustrated by a quotation from Prince Harry speaking at a January 19th event about his and his wife's Meghan's decision to step back from royal duties and give up their Royal Highness titles. And a quotation from Prince Harry in bold black and all caps, quote, "It brings me great sadness that it has come to this," unquote. Finally, in the top margin of the page, running along the top, is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 590. Caption explains, population of Toksook Bay, Alaska, according to the 2010 census. As of January 21, the remote village was the first community counted for the 2020 census, 590. Now we turn to the facing page, which is the beginning of the major section, The Brief. Opening The Brief is the section called Opener. And in a chapter called World, the headline is, "A deadly new virus goes global." Times says, by Charlie Campbell, Dateline Wuhan, and Amy Gunia, Dateline Hong Kong. And they write, "Lunar New Year is a time for travel across China, as people make up to 450 million trips abroad for vacation or go back to their hometowns for meals with family. But a deadly virus is also on the move, putting a damper on the celebrations, which fall around January 25th this year. The outbreak of a viral pneumonia-like illness was first reported in December in Wuhan, a major city in central China. Health officials quickly identified the pathogen as a coronavirus related to the virus that caused the severe acute respiratory syndrome, parenthetically SARS, that's all caps, S-A-R-S, SARS outbreak, which began in southern China in 2002, killing nearly 800 people and turning bustling cities across Asia into ghost towns. The new virus sickened more than 500 people in China and led to 17 deaths as of January 22nd, and had been detected in Japan, Thailand, South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. A day earlier, the first U.S. case was reported in a Washington State resident who'd visited China. As the virus spreads, the world watches warily nervous that Beijing will repeat the public health fiasco of SARS. There was a lot more to this particular article, but in favor of getting more material into our reading, we move on. On the facing page, the section is the bulletin, where the headline is, Countries Fighting Over Libya Pledge to Stop. Article by Joseph Hinks. At a January 19th summit in Berlin, a dozen countries promised to stem interference in Libya, the North African nation that has been a battleground for competing factions and the foreign governments that back them. Leaders from Russia, Turkey, and 10 other nations called for a ceasefire and agreed to sanction those that break a UN arms embargo. All agreed that, quote, only a Libyan-led and Libyan-owned political process can end the conflict and bring lasting peace, unquote. There is more to this article, but again, in favor of getting as much material in as possible, we move on. On this page is a photograph, and the caption explains. The caption's title is Open Carry, and then goes on to say, thousands of gun rights advocates descended on Richmond on January 20th to protest gun control measures proposed in Virginia's Democratic-controlled state legislature. Protesters were banned from carrying weapons on Capitol grounds, but many came armed to demonstrate in the vicinity. Though interest in the event among white nationalist groups had sparked fears of a repeat of the violence that rocked nearby Charlottesville in 2017, the day proceeded peacefully. And the photograph includes a candid photo of a group of the protesters. One individual is carrying the state flag of Virginia, blue. Another protester is carrying the stars and stripes, red, white, and blue. On the right margin of this page is the feature news ticker. It's the collection of three news items in the margin, one stacked on top of the other. Top item, Africa's richest woman in hot water. Authorities in Angola are investigating Isabel dos Santos, Africa's wealthiest woman and a daughter of a former Angolan president, after media outlets on January 19th published 700,000 documents purporting to show that she misused state resources to get rich. She has denied the claims. Middle item. U.S. court dismisses climate suit. A lawsuit brought by a group of young people intending to force the U.S. government to address climate change, Juliana v. U.S., was dismissed on January 17th by a panel of federal judges in the Ninth Circuit on the grounds that the plaintiffs lacked legal standing. The litigants plan to ask the full court to review the decision. Bottom item, China targets single-use plastics. China unveiled a plan on January 20th to drastically reduce the amount of single-use plastics used by its 1.4 billion people. The measures include a ban on non-degradable bags in big cities by the end of 2020, in all urban centers by 2022, and everywhere by 2025. Restaurants will have to scrap plastic straws this year. Entire contents of this section of News Ticker. That brings us to the major feature, milestones. Lead item. Under died. Terry Jones, Monty Python's Eclectic Mind, observance written by Melissa Locker. When the Oxford English Dictionary added Python-esque to its pages, Terry Jones didn't take it as a compliment. The mission of Monty Python, the influential comedy troupe of which Jones was a founding member, was to be, quote, unpredictable, unquote, and unquantifiable, unquote, he said at a reunion in 2009. To be distilled into a mere adjective meant they had, quote, failed utterly, unquote, in that quest. But Jones, who died on January 21st, at the age of 77, could not be defined. It was while studying at Oxford that Jones met Michael Palin. They eventually teamed up with John Cleese, Eric Idle, Graham Chapman, and Terry Gilliam to form Monty Python. Their groundbreaking TV show, Monty Python's Flying Circus, combined quietly uproarious sketches with rapid-fire wordplay, historical jokes, and Gilliam's surreal animation. Jones helped write a sketch about a singing, cross-dressing lumberjack and portrayed both a nude organist and a cardinal in the Spanish Inquisition. As the Pythons moved to feature films, Jones moved behind the camera. He directed Monty Python's Life of Brian, while also delivering one of the film's funniest lines, dressed as a mother and declaring, quote, "He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy," unquote. Beyond the bounds of Pythondom, Jones wrote numerous books, published essays against the Iraq War, and drafted the screenplay for David Bowie's cult classic, Labyrinth. He also became a noted scholar of medieval history. Monty Python and the Holy Grail fans may laugh at that last bit, but Jones would probably be glad. Observance by Melissa Locker, Terry Jones. This item is accompanied by a black-and-white candid shot. Caption explains, Jones at work in 1974 in a script conference for the BBC's Monty Python's Flying Circus. And he's about to laugh in the photograph. The right margin of the page, under, named, USS Doris Miller, honoring history. Observance by Olivia B. Waxman. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, Doris Miller's role in the U.S. Navy was as a mess attendant. That didn't stop the 22-year-old from helping the injured and firing at enemy planes. The Navy credited his heroism to an, quote, unidentified Negro messman, unquote. But black newspapers and rights groups found Miller and made him the face of a campaign to end the policy that limited African Americans to kitchen and maintenance duty in the segregated armed forces. On May 27, 1942, Miller became the first African-American Navy Cross recipient. Days later, the Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard started enlisting African-Americans into general service. Miller remained a messman, dying in 1943 when a torpedo sank his ship. But his name grew only more prominent. At a Martin Luther King Jr. Day ceremony on January 20th at Pearl Harbor, the Navy announced a new aircraft carrier, the first named after an African American, the USS Doris Miller. Entire observance written by Olivia B. Waxman. The USS Doris Miller, named for Doris Miller. This is accompanied by a black-and-white, half-length, formal photograph of Doris Miller, no caption. Doris Miller is standing at attention with a newly pinned Navy cross on his chest in his white naval uniform. In the left margin of the page, under died, jazz saxophonist and composer Jimmy Heath died on January 19th at 93. Under agreed by the U.S. Supreme Court on January 17th to hear a case on a Trump administration rule that would allow employers exemptions from providing birth control coverage under Obamacare. Under acquitted, Future Forward, one of Thailand's largest opposition parties, on January 21, acquitted after a legal petition accused it of working against the monarchy and having links to the Illuminati secret society. Future Forward, acquitted. Under revealed, that attempts to lower emissions of hydrofluorocarbon HFC-23, a powerful greenhouse gas, appear to be failing, according to a UK study published on January 21. Under exploded, a SpaceX rocket and a successful test of the abort function for the company's Crew Dragon spacecraft on January 19th. Under sentenced, former Interpol president and Chinese police chief Meng Hongwei sentenced to 13 and a half years in prison for bribery, sentenced on January 21. His wife said the case was politically motivated. Under gathered, delegates from nearly 50 nations in Jerusalem to mark 75 years since the January 27th, 1945 liberation of Auschwitz at the largest global political event in Israeli history. Entire contents of the milestones page. On the facing page is another edition of News Ticker. Again, it's three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, UN condemns hacking of Jeff Bezos's phone. After a number used by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was linked to a hack into the phone of Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, a charge Saudi Arabia denies, UN experts said January 22nd that the hacking was meant to, quote, influence, if not silence, unquote, the paper, which had employed murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Middle item. Populists exit Norway's government. On January 20th, Norway's populist Progress Party pulled out of the ruling coalition after opposing the repatriation from Syria of a Norwegian woman with suspected ISIS ties and her two children. The remaining groups in Prime Minister Erna Solberg's center-right coalition will stay in power as a minority government. Final item. Change in U.S. school lunch rules. The Department of Agriculture announced on January 17th a proposal to change school meal rules championed by former First Lady Michelle Obama. The revisions, which officials say are meant to reduce waste, would allow cafeterias to serve kids fewer fruits and vegetables. Going forward, we are now in the section called The View. And that leads us to the risk report, where the headline is, Iran is left with few strategic options after Trump's bold move. Article by Ian Bremmer. Scoring legitimate foreign policy wins has not been easy for U.S. President Donald Trump. Twitter proclamations notwithstanding, but he's just notched his biggest one yet against Iran. Since Trump decided to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, parenthetically JCPOA, Iran has been careful to take only incremental steps away from the hard-fought nuclear deal in hopes that the other signatories would salvage it, but to no avail. Since then, Iran has spent the better part of a year testing U.S. limits, cyber attacks, harassing tankers, shooting U.S. drones, hitting Saudi oil facilities. The U.S. response to all these has been notably restrained, at times infuriatingly so from the perspective of allies. When the U.S. finally did respond with the shock escalation and assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds force, it sent a clear message to Iran that the U.S. was done being cautious. Trump has argued in the past that his at times erratic approach is to his advantage. Quote, I don't want people to know exactly what I'm doing or thinking. I like being unpredictable. It keeps them off balance. Unquote. In a world as chaotic as ours, it's a questionable strategy, parenthetically, especially when it comes to dealing with our allies. But one that has paid dividends. In this case, had Iran not shot down Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752, it's possible the rest of the world would be applauding Iran for its attempt to de-escalate tensions by shooting missiles into two U.S. military bases in Iraq and giving enough warning to ensure zero fatalities, parenthetically, though a few U.S. troops were wounded. But as it is, the Iranians' misfire cost them any goodwill that the world was willing to spare Tehran's regimes. Iran is now under massive pressure from within and without. The Iranian people are suffering under tightening sanctions that have brought the country's teetering economy to its knees. The European signatories to the deal, while still hoping it can be salvaged in some way, are increasingly reluctant to spend their own political capital for an Iranian leadership that seems just as determined as the U.S. to force the world to choose sides, even at the cost of civilian lives. Germany, France, and the U.K. have now triggered the dispute resolution mechanism written into the JCPOA, a clear signal to Iran that they are no longer willing to let Tehran inch closer to a nuclear weapon while they wait for the 2020 election and hope the American people vote Trump out of office. At this point, waiting out Trump is the only hope Tehran has left. If Trump wins another term, it will be near impossible for Tehran to avoid renegotiating the nuclear deal if it wishes to escape sanctions. But given just how large the divide between the country's hardliners and reformists has become, that's a tall order. With the benefit of hindsight, it's becoming clear that the biggest mistake Iran's reformists made wasn't signing the JCPOA, but overselling the benefits of that deal to the public. Parenthetically, a criticism that can also be lodged against the Obama administration, if we're being honest. A diplomatic breakthrough never came for Tehran, nor the economic revitalization that was promised them. Achieving foreign policy breakthroughs is hard enough. Overpromising and underdelivering on those breakthroughs can be a tragic mistake. A lesson that Iran's leadership, America's, and the rest of the world's leaders would do well to heed. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. In the sidebar of this page is the subsection called Language, where the headline is How They Won. They is in italics. Article by Katie Steinmetz, and she writes, It is a well-known truth among linguists that the grammatical, quote, mistakes, unquote, of one era often have a way of being proved perfectly correct by the next. In a new book, linguistic scholar Dennis Barron argues that the tide has turned for the most controversial pronoun around, the singular they. For centuries, pundits have observed that English is missing a gender-neutral third-person pronoun that could be used in place of he or she when gender is unknown or irrelevant. People have tried to fill this gap with many words that didn't fit, like generic he, which isn't actually generic, and hundreds of made-up pronouns like thon, parenthetically a combination of that and one, that never took off. The answer, Barron explains, in What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She, has always been the singular they. Though grammarians may insist that it be used only as a plural, the masses regularly use it in a singular way, as in, quote, did they leave a message, unquote. In recent years, it's gained ground thanks to the LGBTQ community, which has embraced it as a way to refer to non-binary people who identify as neither men nor women. And that helped inspire influential authorities, like copy editors, to put down their red pens. Entire article by Katie Steinmetz. And, for your reference, again, the writer mentioned linguistics scholar Dennis Barron. Barron spelled with one R. And the title of his book is What's Your Pronoun? Question mark. Beyond He and She. That is the title. Going forward, still in The View, we are at the weekly feature called Essay, where the headline is it unethical to watch football with my son? Article by Sean Gregory. Sean Gregory writes, As another Super Bowl approaches, I keep thinking about a clear September afternoon at MetLife Stadium, home of the New York Giants, and wondering if I'm a crappy dad. For the second straight year, I was lucky enough to take my 13-year-old son, Will, to a Giants game. We started the day running routes around the tailgaters in the parking lot. We each attempted a pair of short field goals in the fan zone outside the stadium. Four in a row. Once the game began, we explained the nuances of a two-point conversion to the friendly British fellow to our left, ate too much, and embraced when the home team scored. We wondered if we were witnessing a bit of history. Promising Giants rookie quarterback Daniel Jones was playing in his first home game. The Giants cruised to a 24-3 victory. Sure, Will's Giants didn't win a game for another 2.5 months, but at least he had September. As a parent, I try not to take such outings for granted. I'm positive my son will remember that day forever, just as I can picture the handful of NFL games my father and I attended when I was a kid in the 1980s and early 1990s. But those were more innocent days. Back then, football fans were unaware of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, parenthetically CTE, the neurodegenerative disease associated with football brain trauma. A 2017 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that 110 of 111 brains of former NFL players donated for examination showed signs of CTE. Several high-profile former players who have died by suicide were found to have had disease. The troubling risk of brain damage has compelled some of today's players to retire earlier than they otherwise would have. Carolina Panthers star linebacker Luke Kuechly announced on January 14th that he was stepping away from the game at age 28. As a journalist who's written a lot about the risks of playing tackle football, I would not permit Will to play. Luckily, his paternal genetics have precluded any temptation for now. But should I be okay with his watching the game? Don't his eyeballs help support an enterprise that we know can cause damage to its participants? This is on top of the laundry list of other reasons to tune out, like the stain of disturbing NFL domestic violence incidents, or the apparent blacklisting of a player, Colin Kaepernick, for a peaceful act of protest, or a sudden death of African-American head coach, or a sudden dearth of African-American head coaches, three now as opposed to seven in 2018. Around 60% of the NFL's players are black. There are no African-American majority owners. Fans say they support things like player safety and free speech and racial equality. But pro football is still the most popular sport in America, and TV and digital viewership rose 5% during the regular season. On Super Bowl Sunday, in what may be America's foremost annual display of mass hypocrisy, around 100 million people will tune in. As a sports writer who's relished the opportunity to park myself in multiple Super Bowl press boxes, I'm even more compromised. Not only have I introduced my son to a problematic game, writing about it is part of my job. There is more to this article, but again, we move on in the interest of making sure we get more content. And part of that content is this cover story entitled Children of the Revolution, The Young Faces of Hong Kong's Uprising. Story by Long Ni Barian. Article begins. At 15 years old, Janos is too young to drive a car, buy a beer, or donate blood. But he says he is willing to give his life in the, quote, final battle, unquote, for Hong Kong. Quote, maybe I will die in this movement, unquote, he says, at the edge of one of the pitched battles that demonstrations have frequently become over the past 8 months. As protesters beside him pour Molotov cocktails, the teenager straps on a motorcycle helmet to hide his face from cameras and facial recognition software. Like every protester time spoke with, Janos gave a pseudonym out of concern for his safety. But in his pocket, he keeps a handwritten will addressed to his parents and friends. Quote, I'm ready, unquote, he says, tapping it. Young people around the world, in the Middle East and Latin America and beyond, are railing against sclerotic regimes, economic frustration, and backsliding democracy. In Hong Kong, semi-autonomous enclave of China with liberal traditions, the protesters are seeking to reclaim their city from authoritarianism. At the movement's core are high school and university students who cast themselves as urban street fighters, willing to gamble away their futures if it helps preserve their home. when marchers first took to the streets in June. They had one goal, the withdrawal of a proposed bill that would have allowed extraditions to mainland China. The legislation was eventually scrapped, but the demands broadened amid growing fears that Beijing is eroding the unique freedoms of press, assembly, speech, the unique freedoms that differentiate this cosmopolitan hub of 7.5 million from the rest of China. The end game remains murky, with no consensus among protesters over whether to ultimately seek independence, universal suffrage, or some other semblance of greater autonomy. For now, they have rallied around a common enemy. November brought not a climax, but a crescendo, when police besieged two university campuses where protesters had barricaded themselves with stockpiled weapons, including bows, arrows, and meat cleavers. In daring escapes, students abseiled down multi-story buildings to waiting motorcyclists or swam out through sewers. The standoff gave way to relative calm during local elections on November 24th, in which pro-democracy candidates won a landslide. But the rallies continue, intermittent and vast. Organizers contend 1 million gathered on New Year's Day to show anger at the police's handling of the unrest. The city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, conceded on January 7th that protest violence will persist this year. Many of Hong Kong's young combatants already say they would rather be martyrs than inmates, especially when convictions for offenses such as arson can lead to life sentences in prison. Quote, "I would rather die than be arrested," unquote, says Calvin, 21. Quote, "If I die, at least the fury would sustain this movement," unquote. Calvin considers himself part of Hong Kong's so-called chosen generation, poised to collide with an increasingly assertive Beijing. Born around the time the UK ceded control of its colony in 1997, this Hong Kong generation barely identifies with the world's ascendant superpower, mostly seeing it as a threat to their way of life. Beijing agreed to maintain Hong Kong's separate legal and political systems only until 2047. Those who expect to be in late middle age by then fear they have the most to lose if the freely healing city fails to preserve its autonomy. On top of that, Hong Kong is one of the world's most expensive cities, where economic inequality is starkly visible. Luxury apartments towering over, quote, coffin, unquote, homes made up of tiny subdivided cubicles. Like others of their generation around the world, they endure a, quote, precarious status, unquote, says Edmund Cheng, a political scientist at the City University of Hong Kong, quote, meaning uncertainty in the future in terms of job prospects and in terms of social mobility, unquote. Cheng says young Hong Kongers have found both a collective identity and a sense of purpose on the protest front lines. But in their quest to safeguard their city, they have plunged a thriving metropolis into chaos. In the past, the pro-democracy uprisings mostly consisted of marches so orderly that after candlelight vigils, citizens stayed to scrape wax. Now, high-traffic neighborhoods denser than Manhattan have become scenes of bloody, fast-moving battles. At protests, violent confrontations routinely unfold as crowds thin and stroller-pushing families and older couples retreat. Masked agitators coordinate anonymously via encrypted messaging apps. Dressed in black and donning Guy Fawkes masks, they smash streetlights, burn train stations, and vandalize stores they deem pro-Beijing. Some adopt tactical positions. Quote, firefighters, unquote, extinguish smoking gas canisters, while, quote, fire magicians, unquote, pitch Molotov cocktails. Quote, charge boys, unquote, have bloody welts from rushing police. Quote, we are not scared of dying, unquote, goes one typical chant. Protesters have grown more radical, authorities more repressive, and the middle ground is vanishing. Retail outlets now identify as yellow, parenthetically pro-protests, or blue, pro-authorities. And people vote accordingly with their wallets. Police have seized weapons, caches, and defused several homemade bombs, including two found on school grounds. A man critical of the protesters was set alight in November, while police have shot three protesters with live ammunition, non-fatally. There have been two protest-related deaths. A university student who fell from height during clashes with police, and an elderly cleaner struck by a brick lobbed by a demonstrator. Among the dozens of protesters interviewed by Time for this story, there was widespread certainty that escalation is the only way to confront Beijing. The nonviolent Umbrella Movement of 2014 failed to achieve its goals of electoral reform, and today's generation of protesters is unwilling to abide by red lines. Quote, some people might say we have to kill a police officer, unquote, says M, who asked to be identified only by her initial. Quote, I would not stop them, unquote. Even veteran pro-democracy activists are loath to condemn violence and have credited the frontliners, or, quote, the braves, unquote, as they are called in Cantonese, with forcing the government to backtrack on the extradition bill. And while protest fatigue has set in, public opinion remains largely unified against the government. Quote, the middle and the professional classes are furious at the government and are furious that they have been losing economic power for the last 15 years, unquote, says Juncker. Further concessions appear unlikely, however. Instead of acceding to political demands, Beijing has appointed a new director of the central government's liaison office in Hong Kong to act as enforcer. Since June, nearly 7,000 people have been arrested, more than 1,000 under the age of 18. The next generation of Hong Kongers are already mobilizing to join the fight, with 12-year-olds spotted on the front lines, and elementary school students staging strikes and singing the protest anthem, quote, Glory to Hong Kong, unquote. Quote, if they keep arresting us until no one is left on the streets, then the activity will go underground, unquote, says Sabrina, a 19-year-old student. Behind her, on a highway divider near Victoria Park, a line of graffiti spells out the frontliners' ultimatum, quote, freedom or death, unquote. That is all in caps on the graffiti. quote, there will be no telling, unquote, she says, flashing a smile, quote, when we will come back out and strike again, unquote. Time notes that is, in addition to the authors, with reporting by Amy Guinea and Hilary Leung, Dateline, Hong Kong. This item also includes quotations from the persons who were subjects of the article. This quotation from King, age 17, quote, my family thought I was a peaceful guy marching. Then I told them that I was going to the front line. Since then, they worry about me, unquote. This quote from Cece, age 17, quote, my parents don't know we're dating. They are supportive of the protests, but they're worried about my safety, even if it's a peaceful rally, unquote. That is accompanied by a photograph of Cece with King. Jeff, age 15, quote, my father and mother are opposed to me going to the protests. They don't want me to protest. They call it rioting. Every time I go, I need to hide myself. My father doesn't know I'm on the streets, unquote. This quote from Boris, age 16, quote, I join demonstrations, but I don't stand in the front line. I mostly do backup and raise awareness. I've organized a lot of activities at school, such as a class boycott, unquote. And we have run out of time for today's edition of Time Magazine. We hope you've gained much from our reading in spite of your reader's errors. The content of this program is intended for folks who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. This is your loyal reader, but not error-free reader, Randall Rickman for North Carolina Reading Service, inviting you to join us again next time and anytime for your time.